Think you know how to party? Well, science does. In fact, there are nerds out there that spend their whole lives researching the ins and outs of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
But don't take this nerd's word for it. In the Party Science Podcast, we break down the research behind a good time and a great time.
I'm Dr. Joel Rindelob, a real-life scientific researcher.
And I'm comedian Courtney Dawson, a real-life party girl.
And together, we talk to world experts in psychedelics.
Look at topics like the physiology of squirting and show you how science parties harder than you thought possible.
Stay tuned every Wednesday for a new episode scientifically proven to rock your dome.
This is a Frank Podcast.
On this week's episode of Honest to Who, I have none other than my good friend, Ravinder Hunia. Ravinder is one of the elite journalists here in Aotearoa, covering everything from the Commonwealth Games all the way to her heart, which is MMA. She's had interviews with anybody who's anybody, and now it's my time to interview her. Sit back and enjoy it. It's me and Rav on Honest to Who.
Sis, thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
Man, this has been this has been a long time, you know. Normally you're the one doing the interviews, but look at this, eh?
This is good.
So for those people that don't know the greatness that is Ravinder, what would you put yourself in, you know, like in the kitty of? A journalist? Yeah,
I would say first and foremost a journalist, aka professional stalker.
Yeah. We're all like that.
Yeah, broadcaster and presenter and all that stuff kind of comes. Or producer, journalist, producer is okay. What I kind of.
Because journalism, you've been doing, like pursuing that for a while. It's not just like, and it's one of those professions where you have to keep going, right?
Yeah. So I've been on this journalism journey for, 2024, nearly 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I had a huge passion for it beforehand and has always been sport.
Was it like a school thing? Like at school you were like?
You know what? No.
No.
But my favourite subject was English.
Okay.
So I used to love writing. Like I was one of those nerds that loved writing long form, like stories, speeches. Because you used to do a bit of film stuff in English as well. Like,
I remember that.
Yeah, like shot listing type stuff.
Yeah.
So we did a bit of that. I just loved English is the only subject that I passed at school.
Oh. What about PE? You would have one of those. Oh no, I can't do it today.
I didn't start doing sport till I was 30.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
God, we'll get to that later about all that stuff. But man, so English was the catalyst that was getting in.
Mm.
Yeah. Because I was like that too. I liked writing, but I wanted to just draw.
Yeah.
I wanted to draw
well,
Wolverine.
I liked handwriting. Like I like to get into like calligraphy and all that sort of
thing.
Oh,
you're the one. You're the sister. I was like, can you write my number? Can you write my notes so I can get off PE?
Yeah. When you do your entry in the friendship book, can you like.
The friendship book. Holy, yeah. We go friendship book confessions right now.
Yeah, we're going deep.
Favorite color? Man, that was funny.
Yeah.
Nobody would invite me to get on their friendship book, man.
I would have invited
you. Oh, thank you. Because you just got a nice heart about that. So English, can you remember? Okay, we'll share now. Can you remember as a kid, like a story? And I remember a couple of stories I read, and I was like, this is the best story I've ever read in my life.
My gangster story. I feel like there was one story that I wrote about a witch chasing me down the road.
Ooh.
But it was like real out the gate.
Yeah. Kids write the best stuff. Man.
I know.
When I have to.
It was like a nightmare, I think, that I wrote into a story.
And then you just that's all my own personal ideas.
Chasing me down Beds Road.
Yeah. Man, shout out to Beds Road, by the way. Sheesh. I remember. I wrote the story. It was the sequel to Mortal Kombat. And I was just going in. And then Mortal Kombat came out. What do you know? They copied some of my ideas. But not really.
Yeah.
But, you know, Johnny Cage died on that. And then all of a sudden he dies in the real one. I was like, bro, you know, who's my teacher's been leaking information.
Yeah.
What school did you go to then? What? Let me guess. AO? No? Did you go AO?
Close. Otahu.
Oh, okay. Man.
Otahuhu.
Can we speak on Otahu College for a bit. The amount of talent that's come out of their school is
great,
nuts,
eh?
There's David Longy,
There's
David Tua, There's Mark Hunt, There's Ravinder.
Roger Tuivasa-Sheck.
Yep. Who else? Man. No, Sonny Bill didn't go there, did he? Nah. Oh, maybe for a little while. I have a feeling, but there's just
Homebrew.
Oh, yeah. As, yeah, but what is it about the school? Did you know at the time?
Nah, and I found that a lot of them went there because, you know, there's kind of like a division. There's the ones that come from Mangere East and the ones that come from Otahuhu. And so I felt like all the talented ones came from Otahuhu.
Oh, hey. There's Mangere East ones, just clout chasers.
Yeah. And we were just like up in there, like trying to get a bit of that clout. But it was an amazing school when I was there. And it was, you know, I mean, heavily dominated by Māori and Pacific. So, like, there was no need to even try when it came to, like, culture and all of that.
Mm.
So I think it was just a school that you could go to and feel really comfortable in your own skin, which I think promotes people to be their best.
What buzzes me out the most, eh, is that you have that there and literally you could throw a tennis ball and it's King's College right next door.
Literally over the back fence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because that is – the King's College is the creme de la creme of people that could afford that.
Yeah.
Was there any crossover between those two schools or was it like, nah, here's, you're over on this side, you're over on that side?
Yeah, there was like border control, like absolutely nothing to do with them. Nothing to do with them. We had more to do with like De La Salle and Macaulay than we did with King's College.
Yeah, it's a strange, it's kind of like this little bubble that nobody, unless you can pay to get in.
Yeah.
Nobody's.
Don't talk to us. You can't sit with us.
You can't come and can't come and play on our field. You can't.
Oh, but I'll see them at Burger King after school.
That's when they get hiding.
Yeah. Nah, nah, nah. Some of them kept it real.
So your journalistic kind of, when was the time where you just like, yo, I just want to, this is what I'm going to put all my eggs in that basket to be a journalist?
Well, I was a case manager at Work and Income in Mangere for a few years and just wanted a change. And I had an opportunity to apply for a job at Whakaata Māori. And I was like, oh, this is a cool change. And at the time, obsessed with sport and whatever. So the job was to go in there and archive anything coming through to do with sport. So if there was like league games that went to air on Māori television, rugby games, whatever, I had to shortlist everything that happened and put it into a system so that when anyone wanted to pull something out, like Sonny Bill Williams try, you just, it's this tape at this time, blah, blah, blah. So that was my job, to import all that data.
That's how you got in there first?
Yeah, that was the foot in the door. And then as time went on, also the reporters in the newsroom used to come in and use the archive to fill holes in their stories. So like if they were talking about Springbok tour, they would come in and say, hey, I need this shot for this. This is my story. This is the concept. You know, what shot would look best in there?
Mm.
So it was from that I was like, I was kind of getting my head around putting a story together.
Yeah.
What shots look like.
How would all the puzzle pieces
come together? Yeah, exactly. And I was like, I could do that.
Yeah.
I could just come in and look for my own vision and write my own stories and
kind
of went from there.
And then did, like, was that, like, you got an opportunity on Whakaata Māori, on Māori television?
Cool.
No?
No.
They wouldn't give you a look in?
No.
Okay.
At the time, it was Māori television at the time, they were going through that, you might remember this, a big, not a restructure, but if you didn't have enough, if you weren't competent enough in te reo Māori, you basically, like, you know, things were happening with the receptionist, they didn't have enough te reo Māori, they couldn't work on the front desk anymore. All these changes were happening to... I mean, they were good and bad. The bad of it was those that had been there for a while or, you know, people like myself kind of missed out on opportunities. Not that I don't know te reo Māori, I just didn't know enough to, you know, be self-sufficient in a reporter role. But the good thing about it was that it was the fight to keep te reo alive and going and implementing it and throughout the organisation. So because of that, I was able to work on the assignment desk.
Okay.
So at the assignment desk, I was able to put out story ideas, things that I knew was happening, you know, in the world that was newsworthy. I could put ideas through to reporters. Yeah. I could go out with reporters and stalk them and see their processes, try and pick up some interview techniques, styles, tips, tricks. But yeah, I wasn't ever able to be a reporter.
So with being able to shadow, is there anyone that you shadowed that you were like, wow, like I took a lot from that person when you were at Whakaata Māori?
The first person I ever shadowed was Rahia Temutemu.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, so I went with her to a Silver Fern shoot and that was it for me. I was like, yeah, this is me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, what
was it about that time that you were just like, this is, I can see myself doing this?
Well, first of all, I was obsessed with sport,
mm.
Silver Ferns being like my number one go-to at the time. And it was just cool to see, you know, her working, she, you know, the relationship she had and whatever. It wasn't like a, you know, like a scary place. It was, oh, they're actually like friends and you know people and, oh, you can get along, you know, and just have a normal kōrero. And
people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you kind of realize that when you're talking to these athletes, they're the ones scripting your story, you know, mentally when I think about it, like all the information you get to put into your script has come from them and what they've said. And I was like, okay. So I was picking it up. But that was 100% the moment I knew that this was me.
Because there are moments in everybody's lives where you just go, wow, this is what I want to do. Mm. Like, this is where I'm going to go with things. Mm. And I think, like, sometimes it's cool to just go back and go, oh, I think it was this moment. I think it was that moment. Like, yeah. I've had moments in my time where I'm like, when someone, you know, and it reinforcement, someone will tell me this, but it's nothing like just being there and going, oh, you get that eureka moment, like, yeah. Oh, okay.
That yeah,
like,
a bit of me.
I can do this. This yeah. is nothing. This shit is easy. Let's go. Yeah. So so from Whakaata Māori going all the way through, you were at did that lead you to the Herald or to the
Oh, I never worked at the Herald.
No, not the Herald.
Applied, didn't get the job.
Oh.
Oh, there was a few of those. No. So at the time I was taking te reo lessons at Whakaata Māori. And sitting all the papers that I needed to sit. And Whakaata Māori was like it was a tuakana tēnā relationship with MediaWorks, with News Hub.
News Hub, sorry, yeah. That's what I thought it was.
So we had some of the reporters coming over to Whakaata Māori to do the classes with us, and I met Mike McRoberts.
Oh, the bro.
So I hit him up.
Oh.
So the 2016 Olympics were coming over in Rio de Janeiro, and I was like, bro, any mahi going? I'm desperate to da 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 da. This is what I've been doing, la la la. I'm not asking for a job, but can you point me in the right direction?
Hmm.
He basically got me a meeting with the head of sport, and then I was doing what I was doing at Whakaata Māori and Archive as the team leader at News Hub, and never left.
There we go, eh?
Yeah.
Well, it just does take like one or two people to just believe in you, I suppose.
Yeah.
And was Mike one of those ones for you? Did he just go, this,
yeah.
This wahine's got something?
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Well, hey, I hope that's what he thought. You're still going, so you must have been onto something.
And you know what? I can pretty much guarantee you that I'm not the only one he's ever done that for, you know? So, yeah, I'm thinking a lot of other people have that same story, but I like the fact that it was Te Ao Māori, Kaupapa Māori, learning Te Reo Māori that gave me that connection.
Yeah.
And then got me into mainstream media. Yeah, and then I kind of had to carry on following my juggling that te reo Māori kaupapa path in the mainstream.
With te reo and with just the kaupapa and everything, what was it like, how was your journey growing up? Did you have a lot of te reo in your life and, you know, like as a kid and stuff like that? Was that around?
None.
Yeah?
Yeah, none. So my mum's Māori from Te Puke and my father's Punjabi.
Yeah.
So he migrated to New Zealand and was cutting shrub in Tauranga, Taranaki, and met my mum at the Te Puke pub, rest was history. But back in the 80s, it wasn't, you know, I don't want to say right, but it wasn't, you didn't hook up with Indians. And there weren't many Indians in New Zealand at the time.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, without saying, it was hard for my dad to be accepted into my mum's family and for my mum, 100%, like not accepted in my dad's family. So what they did was packed up, had me and my sister, got a twin sister, and we moved to Auckland. So, but in that—
Started fresh.
Yeah, started fresh. But in that process, you know, you move away from the whenua, you move away from the marae, you're moving away from the reo as well. Mm. So kind of later in life, me and my sister have had to chase it.
Because the chasing it is what I really wanted to get into.
Mm.
Like, when can you remember a time where you're just like, you know, this is when I need to make the change and I need to be more in touch with my reo and more in touch with Te Ao Māori?
Yeah, it was when my kids were born.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So my son's 20, just turned 20. And I have a nephew as well who's just a couple years older than him. And I used to go with him to Kohanga. So when I was with him, looking after him at Kohanga, I was picking up reo, like from the absolute basics. I'm learning with the 2-year-olds, the 3-year-olds, the 4-year-olds, you know.
Mm.
But it's 100% what I needed, you know. Karakia, waiata, reo, kai, all those sorts of things was ingrained in me in those, you know, in that time that I spent in Kohanga.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, the kohanga kids are coming through, you know what I mean? And I think it was said on, and it's beautiful to see, because for a long time there, like, kohanga was dying.
Yeah.
Like, and it was hard. Now it's hard to get your kids into kohanga.
Yeah.
A lot of, there's a waiting list almost. And it's beautiful. And even to go and do a reo class, you know, there's people that aren't necessarily Māori, but, you know, teachers and people that are, like, in the media that are lining up at Te Wānanga just to get on a course. It's awesome to see.
Yeah. I've been trying for 2 years to enroll at Te Wānanga Aotearoa.
Oh, shit.
Unsuccessful because it's so full. So I'll go off and I'll do the tikanga class. Not that it's any less than, but you still want to kind of stay in that
especially
environment.
Like a full immersion, you know, a full immersion one. Oh, man. Because, yeah, I've always wondered that because, you know, with your upbringing being mixed like that, was there any, like, was it dad's side of the family, you know, keeping that culture alive as well as mum's? Was there any in the middle kind of ground that you found?
Yeah.
You had to, right?
Yeah, but it's kind of funny because it kind of came across as me and my sisters were like, not the outcasts, but we were like 1 foot in, 1 foot out of the Punjabi culture, which is not necessarily always a good thing, especially if you're female. You know, there's a way about things. There's, you know, you go to school, you have an arranged marriage, you have children, tamir, tamir, tamir. So because my dad hadn't gone through the traditional route, it kind of gave us the freedom to know that if we wanted to take that route, we will. If we don't, we don't. Dad kind of couldn't question it, but but at the same time, like, we went to, because when my mum and dad got together and we moved to Auckland and all that, we had no Punjabi family in New Zealand.
Oh,
so
wow.
My dad was the first of his family, first generation to come over. And his dad was in the army at the time. And so they slowly started coming over, and that was when we were introduced to Punjabi language, because my dad wasn't talking to anybody, you know. There was no one around for us to hear the language.
Oh, yeah.
There was no phone calls to Punjab. It was writing letters, you know. So the only time we heard the language was once the family started coming over. And then we learnt about arranged marriages and, you know,
was
all
that kind
all
of
traditions.
Like hidden? Like, not hidden, but put away? Like, you don't know about
that? Yeah, unknown. Yeah, it just wasn't around us.
Oh.
So we had no clue. And but then once my family started coming over, we were just like, holy crap, we've got uncles and an auntie and cousins that we never even knew.
How old were you when that all happened?
About 10.
Okay, yeah. So you were old enough to understand. And,
And
kind of get a broad sense of what's going on.
And then we start going to temple and gurdwara and, you know, learning about karakia. And then we went to, there's like a Punjabi school as well that you can learn the alphabet and the basics and blah, blah, blah. And so they're all it's like kohanga, but, you know, and they're trying to keep their reo alive as well.
That's a cool way. Like, you don't really think about that because, I mean, we live in New Zealand where it's going like, this is what school is, this is what traditional school is. But, you know, like when languages need to, because, I mean, that's our ancestry. That's our whakapapa. Like, if we're not really about it, I say that, man, I should be on a reo course too. I just get by the skin of my teeth sometimes. And then it's like, oh, yeah, killed it. And then they're moving on. But, you know, it's cool to see that it's happening for the Punjab community as well.
Yeah, and you can see them in full force.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like when I look at, like, both sides of my cultures, like, Punjab is very much like they come and set up almost a mini Punjab, you know, like it's all their people. They're all surrounded by each other and it's business and it's, you know, gurdwara, it's family and it's all very, you know, whereas Māori is a bit more, I think, like spread out. But the beauty of it is like you should be able to feel no matter where you go on this whenua, you know, kei te pai tēnā, like, it's fine because you are Māori, you're on, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of different, but yeah.
Did you get, like, and I can speak on this too, like that identity crisis around who I am?
Yeah.
And did it hit around like 16, 17, where you're just like, man, I don't know what the hell's going on? You know,
well, before that too.
Oh, well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I always was brought up Māori. Like, my mum, I didn't really actually, like, you know, I looked at my skin and I was like, oh, man, I'm a bit different to my cousins and stuff like that. But I always knew I was Māori. And, like, I knew. You know, and you look at my mum, she's fair-skinned as well. Mm. You know, like, people would look at her a bit weird. But when I actually did, I was about 12, maybe 13 when I met my full, you know, like, into it. And then I was like, okay, like, it makes sense now.
Yeah.
Did you ever have that makes sense now kind of?
kind of. Yeah, you have that moment where you're just like,
in Wairua?
This feels like home. Mm. This is exactly where I'm supposed to be. Right now is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And you just feel like toe away, like real calm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the two, just the calmness of everything. And the, you know, when you're on your tūranga waiwai and you're just like, wow, man, this is my home. Now I see I see my maunga, I see my awa. And yeah, it's a different buzz, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's, but the belonging is what I wanted to talk about next, is like having that belonging to a culture and where you go with that. Mm. Like how was navigating that for you?
It was quite tough. Me and my sister, so there's three of us sisters, right? And me and my twin sister, we've got a younger sister 2 years younger than us. My younger sister, olive skin, long dark black hair, she looks Punjabi.
Oh, wow.
Me and my sister, and she's a spitting image of my dad. Me and my twin sister, we have traits of my dad, but we're spitting images of my mum, who's a very, you know, Ma Māori. But there were a lot of times that, you know, me and my sister would go, you know, Gurdwara and whatever, and just feel out of place.
Mm.
We're just like, we don't look like anybody here. People are staring at us. You know, we felt really uncomfortable. We felt that sometimes we were treated differently, whether it was our paranoia or our, you know, intuition. That's, you know, we were quite young at the time, but I know that a lot of it was, you know, the intuition part. And we didn't have the reel either, you know, the Punjabi reel. So we kind of felt, you know, a lot out of place, and it felt more comfortable to lean on our taha Māori, or just being in the hustle and bustle of Auckland, you know, the metropolitan that it is. We fit right into that.
Oh, man.
You know, so we were right at home in the city. But yeah, it wasn't until, like I said, like I had my kids, I was just like, okay, now I have to explain to them. You know, I had to go through all of that. And now they're going to have to go through all of that.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I think I'm in that position at the moment.
Mm.
My kids are Nui and then Māori. And, you know, like at the time, I'm like, no. Just the hustle and bustle of the culture of life. You just deal with that. You'll be fine. But now I'm like, nah, I could have done it's all a coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Oh, absolutely.
No, I could have done a better job there. I could have done a better job there. But there's nothing like moving forward and trying and getting things sorted. But yeah, there's always that, eh? And then when my old lady's like, hey, bloody hell, they're not speaking the reo properly. Oh, sheesh. Trying, man. Sheesh.
Yeah.
But yeah, Anyway, back on your journey with journalism. Jeez, just, I like this though. Hey, that's us though. We can do that. But yeah, back on journalism. So you went straight from there, straight to the Olympics? Did you go to the Olympics in Rio?
I never went to the Olympics. I just worked in New Zealand on the Olympics.
On the Olympics, okay. Yeah. But you've been to an Olympics before?
Nope.
Commonwealth.
Commonwealth Games. Yeah.
It has to be on the card soon, right?
Olympics?
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to the Olympics.
Oh, man.
I've got too much business to sort here.
That's right. But so learning from, you know, doing all that stuff with Whakaata Māori to now, at the News Hub, what was the main job changes? Because you were at the reception, the story desk, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're moving from there. So you had to pick up quite a lot real quick?
Yeah. Yeah, so my producer at the time, Sam Ackerman, he like looked after me, like in terms of, because you know when you're in a newsroom, you either you're chasing your stories or you get distributed a story or idea to chase. And because I'm, you know, absolutely green, he gave me a story to do. Was a female swimmer who was the only woman to ever medal at an Olympics in backstroke. She won a bronze back in the days. And he said, would you like to go out and have a kōrero with her? I was like, hell yeah, I want to go and have a kōrero with her. I got, you know, because there's so many ways you can take that story. So I'm not saying that it was a softball interview, but it kind of was, you know.
Yeah.
But for that story, I learnt, and that was my very first one, and I still go back to that story because it taught me a lot about connection, being in someone else's whare, and, you know, trying to respect that while trying to get a story out of them, because sometimes there is kind of a push when someone has an agenda to try and get something out of them. Like if I think about this, you know, wahine back in the day swimming, blah blah blah, like I'm interested to know, man, where did you train, because you weren't training with the men and you know all of that. There was a lot of things back there. So you know, she's telling me about how she had to swim in the ocean. That's where she got her training done because she couldn't train in a pool with the men.
Wow.
And one of those men were her husband.
Wow.
You know?
Probably like, hey, you go swim over there. Yeah. I'm hanging with the boys.
Yeah.
Or Papa Manu's with the boys.
See you soon.
Yeah.
But she's out in the ocean.
And get us a fish. Go and get us some kina, girl.
Yeah, go diving. And she's there like looking at the buildings, guessing the length that she had to do. You know, there's no markers for her. And she's getting ready for an Olympics. You know, so there were all these cool stories, man, that I didn't want her to feel upset about, that I wanted her to be, you know, it's an adversity that I wanted her to, you know, I wanted her to feel proud, you know, and I wanted her to have that moment. And that's when I learned that going out and interviewing people, you're capturing one of the biggest moments of their careers or their lives, you know? And I want them, whenever they look back on that story, to go, man, I did some shit, you know? And then their family are watching that going, man, nan, auntie, mum, mean, you know?
See, they don't think of people, I don't even think of that either. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
Because you're really documenting and, you know, you're documenting somebody else's achievements, but in a way that is, like, as I always, and, you know, I think the world of you when it comes to the interviewing craft. But I think that knowledge in the back, that undercurrent, I suppose, that you come with is that, no, I'm here to help you. It's not about me. It's about you right now.
I'm facilitating.
Now. Yes.
You know, we're facilitators. You know, what we're trying to do is get them to be so proud about their moment that they tell us everything, you know, that they tell us absolutely everything. And, you know, you have those stock standard questions like, how do you feel? And da 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 da. But you really do want to know, how do you feel? But how do you get that out of them without asking, how do you feel?
Yeah.
You know, how do you get that out of them and create a vibe and a wairua? And then you know, yep, okay, that's going to be my opening grab from them because that's mean, you know? So it's just walking into their world, into their shoes. Yeah, I've never thought of being a journalist because I got that story. I have that connection, but it's got nothing to do with us, in my opinion. But that's just how I've always attacked it.
Well, it's a very selfless type of mindset around it. And, you know, like, man, I wish I had some of that because sometimes I'm doing this thing. I was like, how can I make this the funniest shit ever?
But you know what? I could probably do with a little bit more. You know, sometimes journalists do have to be a little bit aggressive because sometimes the story is holding people to account, you know, things like that. So it does kind of change.
I mean, everybody has their what I've noticed in that game of interviewing people, and everyone has their own type of ways of doing things. It's almost like, you know, it's like Street Fighter. You know, you got the Fireball guys, you got the Sonic Boom guys, you got the guy, you got the evil, you know, like everyone's got their the ways of doing things. But there's no wrong way about it.
Yeah.
But it's how good you are at the doing all the buttons. That's how well you go. And if you don't know how to push the buttons, you're an empty vessel.
Yeah.
And that's why I really kind of, I really want to get into your journey because it's interesting, not only because of who you are and how good you are at your craft, but also like in sport, being a female in a very, very male dominated world where in a time where we didn't really care about, you know, there wasn't like, hey, what about the Black Ferns? There wasn't none of that going on.
Yeah.
How was that must have been so hard with your passion of sport and your job to go, this is what I want to do, and then to be like, we've got the All Blacks, you know?
Yeah.
There must have been some tough times. Like, I'm just guessing, I don't know, but was there?
Oh, yeah, the time. All the time. And you say heavily male-dominated, heavily Pākehā male-dominated was another, not a barrier, but something that I wasn't accustomed to. Like, when I moved from Whakaata Māori to News Hub, I got a culture shock.
Oh, sheesh.
You know, I was like, oh, wow, they wear shoes here?
Oh, wow.
They don't karakia before lunch? Oh.
they don't have lunch? They just bring their own lunch?
Yeah. Can I have some? No.
Yeah, oh, okay. No. We're not doing shared lunch every day today?
No,
okay.
No butter?
Oh, gosh. Oh.
But it was like that, but in every kind of sense of it. Like, when I walked into Whakaata Māori, there was a wairua, and you set that tone for the day with karakia and all of that sort of thing. So when I went to News Hub, I had to kind of think of, okay, how do I set myself for the day? How do I walk in and not be green while being green? You know, hold my own type of thing, because it's hard to be, you know, you use the word selfless, but, you know, to walk in with a full heart into an aggressive newsroom. It's, oh, wow. That's tough.
Yeah. I've never had to, I don't, what does that even look like? What is it? Because, I mean, I work at Sky and we just have fun. Yeah. You know, like, yeah. I work at Kroger's Wild and we just have fun all the time. But you know what I mean? Like, what does that even look like from a fresh green, you know, wahine going into this angry, quick-paced Pākehā way of journalism? What does that even look like? What does that newsroom look like? Just people just
fast
get the story.
It looks fast, and you're just looking for, okay, you look at the story, you look at this concept, it's this team, it's that coach, da-da-da-da-da. What is the one thing, what's the one message you want to drive home out of that situation? What's the one thing we want to get out of that, or what's the one answer we want, you know, answered? One question we want answered. And it was very much like that, which was, you know, really out of my comfort zone, because I like to draw stuff out of people.
Yeah.
And then once I find the nugget, I'm like, there it is.
Boom.
But this time being told, this is the nugget, chase it. That was different, you know?
That must be so hard.
Yeah, yeah. And it's super hard. But yeah. I learned quickly that that is 100% how journalism works, you know? And a lot of it, you know, is created by the teams themselves, like they're creating a narrative and then they want you to chase that. You know, it's a web.
Yeah, it is. It seems like a web. There's a lot of different angles that a lot of people, like, from, yeah, because I do the same thing that you just said. I will go in, I will get to know the person, I will find the nugget, mm-hmm. I will go after the nugget.
Yep.
That's where I'm going. I'm going to shine that piece of coal up until it's a diamond.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, like, if that here's the diamond, here's the coal, this is where you're going.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do that.
Yeah.
It must be hard. I couldn't imagine how hard that would be for somebody that's like yourself.
Yeah. There was one time, and I won't name names, that were really not affected me, but I was just like, oh, gutted, was I went to a netball shoot. This netballer was dating a rugby player, but this netballer had just come back from injury. So I wanted to talk to her about, you know, the comeback, la, la, la.
Rehab.
Yeah. What that meant for her family, all these sorts of things. But I was told, we want to know what the rugby player's up to. We're going through her to get it. You know what I mean? So I was just like, that's when I had to kind of think about my values as a human, as a person.
As my Islander friends, that's illo. That's straight paru. You know, for me, I'm just, I feel like you telling me that story, I'm like, I know exactly how you would feel.
Yeah.
Like I know you well, and I know that you'd be like, really? Like, come on now. Like, why can't we uplift our wahine? But anyway, sorry to interrupt.
You know, it was just a reflection of what I thought was respect on the sport, respect on that athlete, and the balance of things. So I learned that day, I was just like, oh, yeah.
I mean, integrity comes into play on that.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? Like, who
and the future proofing.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't the first or last time I'm going to talk to this person. If I was to say that, which I didn't, and got into big trouble when I got back to the
newsroom. You wouldn't have.
I tried like three other avenues, three other pitching to my producer. And he's like, nah. I told you to do this.
Yeah.
And you didn't get it. So I was just like, oh, deflated. But I thought to myself, I'm going to go back one day and talk to that girl. And I'm never going to have to deal with stealing her of her opportunity to talk about her story, which was what I was there for. And hopefully that relationship will, you know, take me further than this one story.
Because if you went the other way and you were just like,
oh, she'll cancel me.
And every time you go back,
nah,
I don't want to. I'll talk to everybody except for that one. She said this about me.
And you know what? I'd be embarrassed to talk to her again too because I did that.
That awkwardness. And, you know, like internally, it burned you away. Because you let that happen, you're going to have to do it for the next person, to the next person, for the next person.
You're that guy now.
Yeah, you're the shock jock. You're the one that's like, hey, can you get this soundbite out of people?
Yeah, but some people crave love it. They love it. Yeah. You know, they want to get that scoop and all those sorts of things. And that's cool too. Each to their own. It's just, I learned that day that it's just not how I roll.
I've been in rooms where, you know, like scrums, media scrums, where, you know, the vibes is all good. And then somebody will ask something like that. And they're just,
and you're like, oh.
And you just, you're like, bro, why you got to ruin it for?
Sink in your seat.
Like, he's just a human. Like, she's a person. Why you got to do that for?
Yep.
And it's all about the clickbaity shit.
And you know what? It's not even about their answer. Mm. It's that they're not, a lot of the time, they're not even wanting an explanation. It's the facial reaction or it's their voice asking the question and them giving you that glare is there. It's all they need, you know, and it answers itself. So sometimes it's shock factor, it's clickbait and all those sorts of things. But I mean, it does build for a story, and as much as news is information, it's entertainment as well, you know, so there's that to think about as well.
Because I think, like, I look back at my journey, I suppose, and it ruins it for people that actually care.
Because
there's people like yourself that actually care about people, you know, like the craft. And by all means, you know, hey, you've got a job to do, I get it.
Yeah.
But you're ruining it for everybody else if you do that. Because, like, I, you know, like, and I've talked to you about Israel, and, you know, like, I totally get why he doesn't do a lot of media, because it only takes 3 or 4 people to ruin their shit for the other ones that, like yourself, and people that actually care about who the person is over who the athlete is.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you know, I get a lot of looks like, oh, here he is again. But what they don't know is I might be joking around, but I know that that person respects me enough and I respect him enough.
Yeah.
And he gives me his time. I give him the best possible effort I could do. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a great point that you bring up. Those fighters are probably the only ones, well, because at the time, I don't know if they were self-managed, but, you know, at the time they were responsible for answering their own questions. They didn't have a media person to deal with, you know, like you'd say, you know, like the All Blacks and things like that, where it's not censored, but kind of. But they stood up and said, you know what? F you guys, we're not going to talk to you at all. Mm-hmm. If all you're doing is going to attack my livelihood or something that I said, you know, straight after a fight when I've put my body on the line and put my life on the line, if those are the things you're going to take out instead of the accomplishments that I've made or 100. Not even end the accomplishments, then I'm not going to talk to you. And I'm like, man, that's a mana move. Yeah.
And then you're waiting outside the fucking courtroom, like trying to get a flick.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, bruv. Like, look at, because I mean, it's been documented quite a lot around, you know, like the treatment that, you know, rugby players would get or leagues would get compared to what the fighters would get. And, you know, it's so clear to see how the disparity between fairness there. And, you know, when you're a fight fan, when you're into the UFC and into MMA and just kickboxing and whatever, you know, like and that's why I take my hat off to all of the bros and sis that are at CKB or wherever they are. They know the real ones.
Yeah.
And they know the ones that work, because you have to work to be good at something like that.
Because you know this too. They are as honest and straight up as they come. A media absolute dream. You know, if you say something, you know, to them and they give you something back wild, man, that's a headline.
Celebrating.
And they are full of that stuff. And I'm so glad that they realized early of that and how the media were using that to get reactions, to get this and that for their own, you know, publications. And that's why you see Izzy with his own YouTube channel and creating his own narrative and being his honest self, you know, doing his thing. Do I think sometimes that, I don't know if you would agree with this, but I do think at the same time that, you know, before they had come into that UFC bubble and were doing the amazing things that they are now and that we're more on the local scene, there was such a cry for coverage, you know? But with that coverage comes so much responsibility. It's the good, the bad, the ugly, you know? What they wanted was, look what we're doing. Look over here. We're representing New Zealand and we're doing amazing. We're really, really good at this. But I don't think they truly realized all of what comes with it.
Yeah.
And that's what they learned the hard way. And so they've pulled it back and are very selective with who they talk with now and what they say.
Yeah, because it is like, and I figured it out when I went to the UFC in Sydney with you. It's it's an international thing. For one day, it's like the Olympics. Yep. Like, you know, everybody's watching. Whereas, you know, like I didn't realize that. Like I went over and thinking, oh, yes, I've done some stuff here. And then when you're going through and you're like, because I remember saying it to you before we went over, you're like, you know, you're going to have to go for the whole week, eh? And I was like, no, just show up on that. No.
Yeah.
Like they don't want to let you in unless you go for the full week. And, you know, like we'll get to that whole shit scenario later. But but I think, I honestly do. But coming back to the fight game, how did you get started into, I mean, you know, competing, I suppose, but just fighting is the thing that you're like, MMA and kickboxing and boxing as well, you're like, this is what I'm going to get. This is my niche. This is what I'm going to get into.
The first thing that I noticed when I, and this was before I was in a newsroom, before I had any opportunity, I was still at Whakata Māori at the time, was zero coverage of fight sports. But Māori television did do quite a bit. Mm. It was just never picked up by anyone, really. Okay. So like we had reporters going to watch Mark Hunt in Brisbane against, you know, Bigfoot. And I was like, how is no one else onto this? No one realised how big Pride was or whatever. We only saw what was inside New Zealand and that's what we were kind of chasing. Mm. Or the absolute superstars, you know, that America might blow up or, you know, whatever, Olympics or whatever. So the fight sport itself wasn't really on a New Zealand radar. But at the time I was training at what was my husband's gym, Oliver MMA South Auckland, and we had two black belts, Richie Barnett and Chris Hawhaia, who were the resident black belts of the gym. And I was just like, man, how cool would it be if I just did a muck around, write a story about these guys and their journey, both Māori, both doing jiu-jitsu. And at the time I was like, what other Māori are doing jiu-jitsu? This is cool. Mm. And a competition came up in Wellington and we were all going down to support the team. And I thought to myself, I'm going to follow these guys around. I'm going to take photos of them. I'm going to write some stuff down like a mock thing. And at the time there was this little publication called The New Zealand Fighter, which was an online whatever. It was mainly an update page. So if you wanted to know what like Ev Ting was up to, Kaikara France was fresh on the scene, Faith Van Duren was still in Invicta. So all of those, you know, emerging fighters were doing amazing things with no coverage. So there was like a little update page and I said, oh, hey, can I please put, I've written this thing about my two jiu-jitsu coaches. Would you let me put it on New Zealand Fighter? And he was like, yeah. So I did that and that was the first story I ever wrote.
Wow. Because, yeah. Because, I mean, there wasn't a lot. I mean, the first time that I ever heard of anything was when Kai got onto Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing, like, I'd go to the King of Rings and go and watch it with the bros and all that stuff. But once Kai jumped on there, I was like, oh, okay, we're kind of getting things moving now. And then, you know, like Danaher, and you're like, oh my gosh, he's like the GOAT at jiu-jitsu and he trains George St. Pierre and all this.
Yeah.
He's like, man, he sounds like a Kiwi. And then you found out he is. But, you know, like there wasn't a lot. There wasn't a lot of things. Do you think that media's changed as in terms of in New Zealand with kind of understanding that this MMA thing is an actual thing, or are we still a couple of years behind everywhere else?
I think we're still a couple of years behind. But I think that's due to no one being, what do you call it? Like nerds of the sport in media. You know what I mean? Like you got your rugby experts, cricket experts, netball experts to an extent. That could be better though. Golf, horse racing, all these sorts of things. And there's never been anyone on the combat scene, despite people like Joseph Parker, David Tua, Shane Cameron. Despite them, there's never been, you know, a group who are hearty combat sport. So that's when I saw an opportunity.
Yeah, and a hole in the market, really. Yeah,
absolutely.
So how did it go from News Hub to Sky? Was there anything in between?
Yep. They wouldn't hire me full time. So I was at News Hub plugging holes. So okay. I was in the sports department, which was my absolute passion. But in order to be there, I had to pick up shifts in general news. I had to pick up shifts in foreign news. I was sometimes on the assignment desk. I was producing on the AM show. So I was doing a whole lot of things just to have some, you know, skin in the sport.
Keep your name there. Get relevant. You know, make sure they can see who you are.
Yeah. Any job that came up, I applied for it. I never got it. But I think I was still really green at the time. But at the same time, I think I was, you know, I had put myself into that utility position. I worked every step. I worked every weekend. I worked, you know, I did all the shifts that nobody wanted. I did the 2:30 a.m., 3 a.m. starts. You know, I did all that stuff that, you know, and I have three kids at home. Mm-hmm. I got a whole family at home. Mm-hmm. I was trying to plan a wedding. I was in camp for a fight and I was still trying to work out all of this stuff to follow the dream. But it was normal at the time. You know, the hustle's always normal at the time. It's not until you look back and you're like, oh, crap.
I know exactly what you're talking about. There's times I'm like, wow, I did all of that. Like,
yeah.
And I still did this and I was able to do that. But you do find time.
It's also through that that you learn your worth, you know. So it was through doing all of that and doing it for a while, I thought, okay, I'm going to apply for a job. If you don't give it to me, I'm out.
Yeah.
And that's what I had to do.
And so where was out for you next?
After RNZ.
That? Oh, okay. That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they gave you that. Was it sports with RNZ or was it everything?
Full sports journalist. My first ever job as a sports journalist. Yeah.
How would that that must have been a great feeling.
Best day of my life.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
It must have just been all this hard work, all these 2:30, 3 a.m. wake ups, all this stuff has paid off for this.
Yeah. And even then, I started again. I'm at the bottom of the pecking order again, and I just didn't care. I've got my desk, I've got my chair, I'm here, you know, on my email, I'm a sports journalist. Mm-hmm. I was like, I didn't care. You can do whatever the heck. I was, you know, covering all sports by that stage, and I didn't care as long as I was in that position.
So you're print and you're doing like news and stuff like that?
Live news bulletins, not Campbell Live, what Checkpoint, that show with John Campbell, and then writing articles as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever think during that transition you were like, I want to be in front of camera, I want to be doing the voice stuff, I want to make sure that I'm there? Was that always... You know, was that a thing? Because
no.
I don't like, you're great at, don't get me wrong, but I do see like that journalist, that not traditional, but that journalist is print and writing things up and helping others shine.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're great at shining on, you're great at what you do on UFC Sky.
Thank you.
Yeah. But you know, when was that moment? When was that clarity where you're like, oh man, maybe I'll give the vocal thing going? Was it a transition? Did you move into it or was it just you're in?
Yeah, I went to the UK for the Cricket and Netball World Cups in 2019. Okay. RNZ sent me on my first overseas trip and I was like, oh my God, this is the best. So I'm over there. I wanted to do the Netball World Cup, but the condition is that I had to cover the cricket as well. And I was just like, okay.
That's nothing to somebody like you. You'd be like, yep,
you know
okay.
What? Cricket for me was that year. I love my netball.
Maybe it's
was
in the blood.
Way more fun. Yeah, yeah.
It's in the blood.
That the Indian, Papa kicked in.
Give me some of that spin,
you know,
bowlers.
I made it into a Punjabi newspaper doing it. Another great achievement.
You did it. So your last name,
my dad's showing everyone at the temple.
Ravinda, she's one of us. Let's chuck her in there. Yeah. Dad would have been so proud.
I know. Yeah.
Would have been like, oh man, my daughter's at the Cricket World Cup. Holy.
Yeah.
Where was that, by the way? It's in London.
It was all over. So the Cricket World Cup, they had the finals in London, but we were in Manchester, Durham. Travelled all around the UK. Yeah, the travelling circus.
So that was the first time being on camera and being on air?
Yeah, so I did some stuff on camera. I had to service all our RNZ shows and give them updates of everything. It was the first time I had been to the UK and I was there by myself for 6 weeks. So there was that component. You know, it's the first time I'd been, you know, away from my family for so long. So there's all these, but you already know when you're on tour, it's so busy, you can't, you know.
You don't have time to think.
No time to muck
it's
around.
Probably like a little bit before you go to bed.
Yeah.
And then you wake up straight, boom, you're
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just have to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I landed in the UK to go on that trip and I got a call from Sky.
Oh, okay. And then now it's all on.
The rest is history.
Yeah. So you, so with Sky, UFC on Sky, what's some of the hardest, I don't want to say boundaries, but getting to do what in your head, what it looks like to what it is, you know, there's some compromise. Where do you see your show with UFC on Sky going forwards? You know, that you're kind of breaking, because UFC and MMA in general is getting huge now.
Yep.
And, you know, you've got to accommodate for it. What is going to be some of those accommodations moving forward, do you think, in media, I suppose? Not just on your show, but in media. What needs to happen?
Yeah. So this is our second year of running UFC on Sky. But we were running, I was running a podcast before that called Playmakers.
Okay.
Where I was getting all the UFC talent that actually drove, it became UFC on Sky because I just always had UFC talent.
Yeah.
Because I've had that working relationship with the UFC for so long, so they just kept, you know, giving it to me and
your stuff.
Not realizing, you know, how much skin in the game Sky had with UFC and pay-per-views, we were the exclusive rights holder at the time.
Yeah.
Before Spark Sport came on the scene and all that sort of thing. So I was like, oh. I said to Ross, as a joke, my boss, I said, oh, we should just have a UFC show. This is hilarious. This is getting ridiculous. And he goes, yeah, we should. And I was like, really? And that's how that came to life. But when you're talking about, you know, where we want it to go and all that sort of thing, the first year of the show, what I wanted it to be was like education. So education on the sport, education on who these fighters were, profiling our Kiwi fighters, even though I had been doing this all my journalism career, I don't know who's paying attention. I know that, you know, our demographic at Sky is very, it's an older audience because they're buying subscriptions. They're very, you know, it's a Pākehā looking dominated audience. So I was like, okay, we strip it all back. We start on the education front. Let's introduce these fighters as human beings with their families, with their hobbies and all these sorts of things. And then we get into the fight stuff. But by that point, when we're talking about, you know, kicking people in the face and blood and all of this, you already know them and their personality and their outlook on life and things like that. So the blow, excuse the pun, is a lot easier to absorb, you know, for any audience.
Yeah.
And then we got a good slot of 6:30, which is like dinner time, you know. So when I did UFC or MMA stories in mainstream media, it had to be on at a certain time after like the dinner bracket because the audience couldn't swallow looking at it while there and that sort of thing. So yeah, it was education was the goal for the first year. And then the second year was, okay, we need to move forward now. What is the UFC? International. We need international buy-in. We need to be on the ground at events. We need to be talking to Dana White. We need, you know, to kind of paint the picture of our why. You know, why are we doing this? Why is the sport so popular? Blah, 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 blah. And just take our audience on a journey, which, you know, it took us to Madison Square Garden in New York, which was
crazy.
Amazing.
Wow.
But also, you know, crowd goes wild, got to go to Las Vegas. So we were there multiple times, you know, as an organization, leaving our footprints as viable media outlets for the UFC. And that's what we wanted as well, because once we have that buy-in, so too will the audience now keep coming back. So the third year, we just want to just carry on with that, get more analysis involved now. We can get more nerdy about it and talk to people who can talk to us about moves and fight IQ and all that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Because, it's just a natural progression, right?
Mm.
Things are growing and so does the coverage needs to grow too. And
yeah.
The acceptance that it's not just cockfighting.
Yeah.
You know, like that's still pretty fresh in a lot of our middle New Zealand mind. And but to go back on, you know, being on the ground, I was very, very fortunate to come over and work with you in Sydney. Mm. And man, that was the buzziest shit
that
ever.
Was good, eh?
I was like, holy shit, this is nuts, man. Like,
it's
yeah.
Full on.
And I remember going to the, and I had that same feeling you probably had going to Birmingham or going to, you know, your first ones. I was like, wow. This is what I'm here to do, and I'm here to work, and I'm here to get this mahi in. And it was life changing for me because I thought, you know, like I'm like, oh, this is my humor. This is what kind of gets me going, and it's just a New Zealand humor, people. But man, I had so many American people follow me and tell me, holy, look at what you can
Aussies.
Do. Aussies love me, sheesh. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty cool. It was a great moment for me, and I'm so glad that you were there to share it because you understand the craft of things, and it's cool for you to, you know, like there's a lot of people that go, oh man, you're funny, but there's crafting and there's a way, there's molding to what you want things to do, and that's what was really good for me is that I could I could talk to somebody else that was into that craft. And it was great. So I just wanted to.
I feel like we nerded out so many times.
And it wasn't even about the MMA stuff. It was about the questions that we're asking. Yeah. Oh, I really like how you did that. Oh, I see what you did there. Yeah. I see how you set that up.
Oh, so I like that cut.
Oh yeah, yeah. I like the segue when you went from here to there. You know, so it was really cool. And but probably the coolest part for me was watching you interview Israel and I want to say it's not just the rapport. It is the rapport, but it's the equity that you've grown with him to be able to trust.
Yeah.
And it's not just Israel. It's a lot of people. Mm. But with Israel being Israel and with Israel Adesanya being that guy at that time and still is. Yep. He's a huge draw. But for you to be able to bring it down and speak to him on that level was in awe. I was like, it's so cool to be in the room. When did that relationship with Israel start for you? To go all the way back. When's the first time you remember interviewing him or having something to do with Israel?
I interviewed Israel before he was in the UFC. So, you know, he used to fight on the local scene often. I think the first time I interviewed him was for a post-fight interview, which was at Auckland Boxing Association. It was the first time, it was called Fair Pay Fighting Fight Night. It was the first time New Zealand had ever done a streaming of a fight night. So it was like new territory. It was a big trial or whatever, but it had big names on it. DJ Reminisce was on it. Izzy, Blood Diamond, Jamie Vanderkuhl was on it. John Vake fought on it. And my job was assisting with the ring announcing because I used to do that on the side hustle and post-fight interviews. So that was the first time that I got to talk to him. And, you know, I felt like I saw him and he saw me and were like, oh yeah, I know who that is. And then moving on from that, I had a hosting gig at the Aotearoa MMA Expo. And he was there, of course, as like a floating, because everyone knew who he was, king in the ring, legend. He was boxing at the time too, fighting in all sorts of divisions, la la la. So he's, you know, a big draw card for anybody. And that was run by the late, great Erman.
Shout out to her. Wow. I'm so glad we got a shout out for Erman in there. Sheesh.
Yeah, but that was his event. And he was, you know, he had his own gym. I think ultimately at Hibiscus Coast was his gym. But yeah, he used to put on these Aotearoa MMA expos. James Tehuna was there. So I sat on stage and did a, you know, Q&A with him. Carly Meehan and Faith was there as well just before her fight with Cyborg.
Oh, wow.
In Invicta. So yeah, there were a few things going around. So I was kind of already chugging my way around, you know, the fight sports scene in a media sense before I'd ever gone into a newsroom. So I think once I got into the newsroom, they're like, hey, I got in here and you got in there. Uh-huh. You know, it's kind of like that. Like we've kind of not had parallel journeys, obviously, but, you know, I was doing what I was doing in media and he was doing what he was doing in fighting. And then our paths just kept crossing.
Because, it was awesome to see. And it was just awesome to be around, you know, like I've been a Israel stan for a long time and, you know, like to follow his journey and to see him just be himself is actually quite like, you talk about parallel things. Like I kind of took inspiration for that because he could just be himself and do what he does. And now I can just be myself and try to get into the mainstream media and not have to, hey guys, it's, you know, I'm here at UFC. Like, it's just me. And that was the coolest part about it. But yeah. And that was a huge, you know, bucket list tick for me. It was like, cool, I got to interview one of my favorite athletes. And, you know, now he recognized me and it was like, oh my gosh.
You know what? That's actually one of the things that stands out in my memories was you building up to that Israel interview. You're like, okay, I've got my da 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 da. And I kind of felt like your interview with Izzy that day, just you hit it out of the park. Oh. It was one of the most entertaining interviews I've ever watched someone else do live.
Because I saw you in the corner and I was like, okay.
I had to apologize because I kept laughing so loud into your mic.
It was fine. It was fine. But yeah, I was just like, man. Yeah, it was for me because I had been chiseling this thing for a long time, and I've still got more stuff that I've chiseled away that I'm waiting for my next time, but you know, like it will happen. But you know, like, yeah, it just seems as if, you know, Israel is he's done so much for his sport and for New Zealand and you know, like the perfect counter and the perfect person, I think, to accentuate and highlight some of the stuff is what you're doing with him. So it was cool and you know, like it was just great to be a part of.
It was cool.
It was pretty cool. On to the next one. Bring us up to 300. Let's go.
We on.
Yeah. Sheesh, you probably have to pay my own way again, but hey, it's all goods. I still owe them money, man. I haven't even paid them back.
Actually, you just reminded me.
Or do they send you to tell me that I owe the money?
We've got the bill, mates, combined.
I was like, oh, yeah, I'll pay it, I promise. Just got to wait for Christmas to finish.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was, it was a very, like, because you've been to a few before that one, but I just think, like, internationally, it's like, this is it. Like, that was all it is. And then we did the interviews at the end, and then I just saw Dana White, and I was like, my bro. And then and then you were doing your interview. This is a true story. Like, we're in the back.
I think I had Sean, eh?
Yeah,
Sean Strickland.
You were speaking
to
someone, and then I just turned my head, and there's Dana White, and I was like, damn it, there's no camera here. So I ran over, brother! And then I turned to look at your head, and you were interviewing, and you're like, this guy is out the gate.
And Sean's like, and Sean was talking to him too.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, they were talking,
right.
And you were talking.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But now it's just like moments like that. Like, that's that for me, that whole week, for me, is like something that I'll always take on and I'll always remember. Mm. And it was cool to have somebody so like, and you directed me in the right places, and you kept me, this is what we're doing to him, this is what we're doing. I'm very, very thankful for that.
No, you are very welcome. I knew from the get-go that it was like, not that I'm anybody's keeper in the space, but, you know, it takes a certain kind of person to be able to come in and have these conversations with fighters. And I felt like they just were drawn to you off the bat, like they had a trust with you. You built a really good relationship
some
with
them.
I
don't know how. Like the Strickland thing.
Maybe
I
the
was
pies.
Like, the, well, no, Strickland. He, sure, Strickland,
oh, Strickland was.
Know.
Oh my God. I think it was, he met his match on the mocking front, so he couldn't help but be like, okay, fine.
I got that just too. He's like, okay, I'll take the cell. I'll take the cell.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But that was fun. That's when I heard you more than anybody. I was like, oh my gosh, sheesh, stop it. I've got to stop. You're just laughing in the mic.
It was like a car wreck and I couldn't look away. Yeah.
He started it too, by the way, people.
Did,
if you look at that video, he wanted the smoke. And then he realized it's too much for me. I need an extinguisher. I got to get out of here. And then remember, right, we tried to do it again, and he was like, just hurry up, ask my questions. I don't have time for you. And I'm like, gotcha, bitch.
Yeah, I win.
I gotcha. Yeah. But, I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens. Like, I don't want to say the face of MMA, but I feel like you're the spokesperson for, hey, this sport's all right, man.
Mm.
This sport is, you know, it's not like you can watch it and not feel like, oh, all the time. There's a science to the sport.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really, and you, there's nobody better, I feel, than you, because you're so warm and welcoming, but at the same time, you know your shit, and you know your how to be a journalist.
Mm.
Not just a clickbaity one, but somebody that actually cares, and there's not many of them around.
Well, that's the secret to any long-lasting relationship. You know, it costs nothing to be kind.
Mm.
I mean, you can get your whatever you need to get. I mean, that's just the nature of the job. You know, everyone goes through adversities and things like that, and no one knows better than a fighter that it's those moments that you learn from the most. So it's all in the way you address that issue with a fighter. Some will get their backs up. Some are more than welcome to talk about it. And then some will just sit back and look at you and go, you know what? True that, you know, like it's just perspective, you know, and talking to people like human beings.
It's not hard to do, eh?
I mean, well, if it was easy, you wouldn't be doing it. Right?
Do you ever get like, and this is like before we wrap up, do you ever get like, you ask, some people go, how did you do that? Like, how did, like, I get it a lot, but
yeah,
like people go, oh, how did you get so much emotion out of Israel?
Mm.
Like, or how did you get Dan Hooker to, you know, talk on this?
Mm.
And do you just want to, I'm just a nice person.
Yeah. It's honestly, it's like what you said, it's that grafting.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like when they talk to me, they can just be uniquely themselves with no consequences.
Mm.
And if you can make someone feel like that, that's where the gold is at.
Oh, there we go. Mm. Thank you so much. We're going to get you back on. We've got another thing on. But thank you for your time and your energy, and thank you for flying the flag, I suppose. Yeah, and it's cool to know you. It's cool to be your friend, and it's cool to be able to, you know, like ask you questions around questions, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and being able to think. So, yeah, thank you, sis.
Anytime, brother.
Yes.
Frank Podcast.
Chris and Guy from the Extremely Casual Gamers podcast. We're a casual gaming podcast for the everyday gamer.
We chat everything gaming from PlayStation to Xbox to Nintendo to PC, but not like full-on stuff, like super chill stuff, casual stuff, like, oh, if you had to date a video game character, who would you date?
Even if you're just gaming on your mobile, we want to hang out with you, and we've got awesome giveaways for you to win.
Join us every Thursday for a brand new episode. Just search Extremely Casual Gamers wherever you get your podcasts.